Hello, this is Dolores Cannon with the Metaphysical Hour. We're back again tonight, and I sure hope that everybody had a nice Christmas. Where we were, we just missed the bullet. They were supposed to call in for snow, but it never really came in, and they got it up in Missouri and other places. So I'm hoping the rest of you around the country are okay. I know I've heard that there's a lot of people snowed in at Chicago O'Hare tonight. They said it may be another day before they can get out of there. So at least I don't have to be on a plane right now. This is my downtime. And you all know I just returned from being gone for 9 weeks altogether. This time of the year is when I try not to book anything. December, January, and into February. It's my hibernation time. Because I live up in the mountains. And we can get bad weather, and I always say I could slide all the way down if I had to, but getting back up would be another problem. And then trying to get over to Fayetteville, where the airport is, if you have bad weather, it's very unpredictable. So I try not to book any trips or conferences for these months anyway. And I do stay home and hibernate and work on books and all the other things I have to do. Right now, I'm trying to finish up Convoluted 3. We're expecting it to go to the printers within the next week. Because I've got all the last corrections done, and it's into book form now. So it's coming down to the wire. We've had a special on it, a pre-publication special. And we have got hundreds and hundreds of orders have been coming in. So it's going to be a lot of fun around here whenever the books get here. And then we're going to have to start packaging and shipping them out. But it's been long overdue, so it's time anyway. Okay, let me give out the toll-free number first before I get started tonight. The number, in case you want to call in, is 877-876-5227. 877-876-5227. I don't have any guests tonight, mostly because I've still been recuperating and trying to get everything caught up since I got back, so I haven't had a chance to book any guests. But you know me, I've got a lot that I can talk about. My kids are always saying, you don't have to worry about never running out of things to talk about. Well, I have 14 books out, so there's a lot of these books that I haven't talked about on this show. Even though I've been on the air now for over 2 years, there's still a lot that I haven't brought up. So I thought tonight I was going to be talking about one of the books that I haven't mentioned before. Now, you know, in the beginning of my work, I've been doing this work now 30 years. And my books have been out now for 20 years. The first ones came out. I began writing the books in the beginning of the 80s because it took me 9 years to find my first publisher. I think it's rather amusing. I get these letters and calls from people because I have my own publishing company now that I hit hundreds and hundreds of manuscripts. And people think that the book should be printed right now. I tell them when they submit something to me, it can take 6 months before it'll even get looked at. And this is regular for the industry. A lot of bigger publishers, it can take as long as a year before they even look at the manuscript. Goes into the pile that's received, and we try to read them in the order they're received. And I get people writing in and emailing, and they'll say, but I don't want to wait 6 months. My baby's ready to be born now. And I think that's so funny because even after it's accepted, it has to go through so much before it can ever get printed and be on the shelves. It can take a lot longer than people realize. But in the beginning, when I went through everything that a writer goes through, I have had absolutely everything that could possibly happen to a writer has happened to me. I had all the rejections. I went through agents. I had a lot of problems with agents, and I really don't recommend them, and I don't like to work with them in my company. I do it if I have to, but I'd rather work with the authors individually. I went that route. I went through two different agents, and I had trouble with both of them. My first publisher, the only thing I can say good about him was he did get the books out. He got the Nostradamus were the first ones to be published in the late 80s. And so he did get them into print, which is the only good thing I can say about him. But there were a lot of other things that happened that ended up with me breaking from him and eventually forming my own company. But I said, everybody has a purpose. Everything has a reason. So I guess his purpose was that he was able to get the books out, and it was a beginning. But it took me 9 years of rejection, heartbreak, all the horrible things that an author goes through. It took 9 years before I finally found my first publisher. I like to make jokes about it, rather like having a child, you know. Instead of taking 9 months, it took me 9 years. And by the time I found my first publisher, then I had a litter. Because instead of one book, by that time I had five that were already completed. And so they began to be printed one after the other. So anyway, I've been there, done that. So it's amusing to me when these beginning authors do send the manuscripts in and think something should be done immediately. But everything has to go in the stack of submissions, and then we read them. I, in particular, it's another one of the things that I do out of the many hundreds of other things I do, is that I read all of the submissions personally. I don't have a reader on staff that I give these things to. It would help because I can go through so many of them before I finally find one that I think this is, I think, deserving to be printed. A lot of people can write, but they don't have a story to tell. Other ones have a story to tell, but they don't know how to write. There's differences. You have to be able to write and also tell the story, and you have to have a twist. Nowadays, you got to have an angle, you got to have a twist to make it be a successful book. Now, a lot of the books I have published have not sold as many as I would like them to. I feel a compulsion sometimes. I'll read a manuscript and I'll say, this book needs to get out. But still, it's always in the hands of the people who go to the bookstores and buy the books. That's where it all lies. You can publish the book, you can get it into the store, but if people don't buy it, then it just sits there on the shelf. So we don't have any control over that. We do as much as we can as a publisher. And a lot of authors don't understand that. And after so many months, the bookstore will return the books back to the distributor because they want to make room for more books. There's so many thousands of books that are coming out constantly. So this is a complicated business anyway. But I've been involved in all phases of it, so that's how I can tell from the author's point of view and also from the publisher's point of view. But anyway, tonight I wanted to talk a little about some of my other books that I've not brought up. In my early days, when I first began doing this, before I got into doing the therapy full-time, I was mostly interested in the past life regressions, and I was interested in the history. Because I've said I am really consider myself to be a reporter, the investigator, the researcher of lost knowledge, because all of the books I've written seem to have something in there that have not been known, been forgotten, or it's been lost. That's what I focus on. Lost history, lost knowledge. To me, that is so wonderful. I can spend all day in a library looking for something. And if I find one little piece of information, to me, that's like finding a jewel. That's how much I love doing the research that goes into my books. And when I do magazine articles or anything dealing with publishing, the bookstores, everybody tells me they love the books because they said you have done your homework and it shows. Meaning I have done the research. And they said if an author does not do the homework, do the research, it also shows. So that's a bit of advice out there for people who want to write. You better make sure that everything you write about is backed up in accuracy. Because otherwise it's going to come back on you. You have one piece of information in your book that's not accurate. It reflects on the entire book. And people will think, can I believe anything that's in that book? But when I'm getting ready to write a book, and I have finished with all of the sessions going into that story, then I begin doing my research. You never do the research when you're doing the sessions, because the skeptics always say, well, you knew about it, you influenced them, you were able to influence the subject by ESP. Now, they haven't been able to prove that yet, but that's one of their arguments, that if I know anything about the topic, or if the other person I'm working with does something about the topic, we're transferring the information mentally by ESP. But if none of us know anything about it, and the information comes out, it has to be coming from somewhere else. That, to me, gives it a great deal of validity. So that's what I mean. I don't do research, and I don't suggest anybody else do research while you're gathering the material. When I have all the sessions done, beginning to put the book together, then I do the research. Is that a caller or what?
I'm a caller.
Oh, okay. I hadn't even got into the story yet, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Well, I thought I would beat you to the punch.
All right, because I was leading up to it. All right, go ahead.
This is a very brief question. First off, my name is Anne, and it is a real pleasure to speak with you. It's
okay.
A real honor.
I never know when somebody's going to call in. They just make a little noise online to tell me. So go ahead.
Okay. I've been listening to you for a very long time, and while you were gone, when you were on your trip, when they were replaying some of your old shows.
Yeah, on the archives. Uh-huh.
Right. I actually listened to it the first time, and then it sort of jogged my memory listening to it again. But it was your interview with Mary Rodwell.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I was at her house when I was on the trip in Australia.
Well, I should have contacted you before you left then, because I actually sent her an email that she never responded to, but I think she probably thought I was crazy.
Oh, no.
So,
people tell me that all the time with me. They say, oh, I can't tell you this. Everybody will think I'm crazy. Mary does a lot of this strange research, too.
Right, but I sent her, it was based on, she was talking about, the Star Kids.
Yeah, that's her main focus right now.
And there was one thing striking. Well, I actually went on her website during, your interview with her.
Yeah.
And there was a questionnaire she had. I don't remember whether she actually mentioned it on your show or whether it was just on the questionnaire.
Yeah.
But it was something I'm wondering, either maybe you might remember in conversation with her, or if it's something that you just happen to know about.
Because I've also dealt with the new kids, too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And my question is something that I have experienced personally among one in particular that sort of jumped out at me, because it was the most inexplicable of all these so-called symptoms or manifestations, and it had to do with dreaming and dreaming of choking on these substances or thick substances. And I was just wondering, I actually had spoken to some other people who had similar dreams to me, not many people.
Okay,
but it's such enough.
I haven't got that straight. Dreams of what?
Dreaming, while you're dreaming, you
yeah.
find yourself choking. And it's like you're choking on something.
Oh, choking. Okay. That's what I didn't get. I didn't get that word. You mean while you're dreaming, you feel like you're choking?
Correct.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, and it was listed on her questionnaire, and it just struck me because I've always wondered. It doesn't happen to me very often, but it does happen, and it's happened to me my whole life.
Yeah.
And it's like there's just something in you that you're trying to get out of you, and it's only happening more like right before you wake up.
Okay, just when you're coming back, you mean? You're getting ready to come back to consciousness?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And
then
it doesn't
you have
happen-
the feeling of choking?
Right, like I'm choking on something in particular.
Yeah.
And it was mentioned on Mary Rodwell's questionnaire, and it just I just about fell off my chair when I read it.
Well, see, I haven't really read her questionnaire, and I didn't know that was in there. It's the first time I've heard of it.
It's in there. She has actually, I think, two or three different questionnaires, and it's on the very first one.
Was this supposed to be a symptom of being one of the new children, or what?
Well, I guess so, and I'm not exactly a child. You know, I'm, 50 years old.
Or was it something to do with UFOs?
No, it was on the Star Kids questionnaire.
Okay, because she also works with UFOs too, so I thought maybe, okay.
And
no,
this,
you're not one of the new ones.
You got that right.
Yeah, you'd be one of the age of the older ones. Because I've spoke about this before, there's three waves of people that have come in. But, anyway, that's what you were wondering about, if that was a symptom of something or what?
Or if you just knew anything at all about that. Because when I emailed Mary Rodwell, I told her exactly what I was telling you just now.
Yeah.
And I guess what I wanted to know is, where did that even come from? What, I mean, because there had to be some sort of implication to what.
That's it. I've never heard her mention that, and I've never heard it in association with what you're talking about. See, I spoke at her group. Every time I go to Perth, I go over to her house. She's a very old friend. And we mostly stick with UFOs and things like that whenever we're talking of the group or crop circles or something. But I've never heard that in connection with the new children.
Well, it is, like, there's several categories on this questionnaire, and it's under the dreams category.
Yeah.
And maybe you could make, like, a note or a mental note the next time you speak with her, just ask her what that's all about. Because I would
put it in another category, not with new children. But that's why I'm surprised that it was me with her. But she may be coming up with things I haven't heard of. But, you know, it's like all of us. I know I have such a huge email list, and maybe it takes her a long time to get through things, you know.
Yeah, well, this was about a half a year ago or so that I emailed her.
Yeah, okay.
Her.
I know.
So I think that she probably just pitched it.
Oh, I don't understand to do that. But let me give you my idea anyway.
Okay.
But this happens once in a while, you said?
Intermittently. It's one of several symptoms. This is not the only thing. You know, I've long suspected, even when I was a child, I a lot of strange manifestations.
Yeah.
It's just that this was one that I never associated with anything other than just a dream. But now I have a whole different, I view this in a whole different light now that I saw it on her questionnaire.
Yeah, it makes you wonder. But the only thing I could come up with, and you said this happens just before you wake up. That's usually when it is?
Well, it probably causes me to wake up, quite frankly. I mean, it may, I think that it's because it's a little, it's, I don't want to say it's upsetting, but I'm definitely kind of, it's kind of like you feel like there's some sort of like taffy or something, you know, it's that kind of texture to it, being pulled out of you. It's just the darndest thing.
Yeah.
And the fact that,
you'll start coughing in the middle of the night and it'll wake you up or something.
Right. Well, this is definitely not a cough. This was, it's like, I don't know what it is, but it's,
yeah.
it's, It's weird. It's just very weird.
Something I've found, and it may or may not be the answer anyway, but you know, every night when you go to sleep, you do go out of your body.
Right.
Yeah, because we don't stay in our bodies.
Right.
The soul, the spirit, is the real you, and the body's the part that gets tired, and it's the part that has to go to sleep. And the real you would get awful tired and awful bored sitting around waiting for the body to wake up so it could continue with its work. So while you're asleep, the body's asleep, the real you is off having all kinds of adventures. You know, you're going to the spirit world, you're going to outer space, other planets, you're going all over this world, you can do anything you want. And the only time we have memories of it is if we have dreams of flying or strange places. A lot of people are doing work during the sleep state, too, helping spirits cross over and all kinds of things like that. Some people say they wondered why they were so tired when they wake up in the morning, because they've been working all night. But that happens a lot. And what I found, see, when you leave the body, when you come back in, because you are attached with a silver cord and you have to return, and it's like when it's time for the body to wake up, you're more or less reeled in, so to speak. But some people have told me they have these feelings of being paralyzed right before they wake up. They're not all the way awake, and their body is paralyzed, and they can't move, and of course, it's very frightening. And what I've found is if something happens just before you're going to wake up, be a noise in the house or something that startles you awake before you're all the way back in the body, then it causes the paralysis because of all of the connections. The brain-body connections are not all hooked back up yet. And it just takes it a few minutes. It's like startles them. Takes it a few minutes to get back to where it's supposed to be so that it can be functioning normally again. I know that doesn't quite answer your question.
But it could be something similar to that.
That's what I was thinking. There could be a connection as you're coming back in the body. Everything is being more or less reconnected.
Right.
It causes that kind of a reaction.
Especially, do star kids have different reconnections compared to, I don't know if everybody is a star kid, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But do star kids have different, you know, when they're re-entering their bodies, do they have different sort of feelings or sensations or things happening to them? Or
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, don't think much about it, except the one when they feel they're paralyzed, that always kind of frightens them. And I always say, just give it a minute or so and everything straightens out, everything's okay. But maybe it's something to do with the reconnecting back in that causes this reflex of feeling like you're choking.
Yeah, I mean, there is a substance there. It was exactly as Mary Rodwell put it. It was just uncanny. The wording was, like I said, I felt like I got hit by a truck when I read this. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, I could not have worded it any better because I really never knew how to word it properly until I read it.
I wonder if it's on her website.
Well, I was looking. I looked all over the place, especially after she didn't respond to me. So I thought I could figure it out on my own. I'd find the answer somewhere in her information.
Oh, I hear so many strange things, you know. But I was thinking if she had the questionnaire on her website, maybe I could look it up and see what's in there.
Well, yeah, and it's, like I said, there's a few questionnaires. It's questionnaire number one under dreams. So I think that you might find it, especially when you see it there, and there's a few other very intriguing, you know, sort of characteristics.
Yeah.
And like I said, the next time you speak with her, I would just love it if you could, you know, broach her on the subject and ask her about it and maybe just discuss it on one of your shows.
From, you know, where that idea came from, but what it refers to.
Yeah.
But you notice a lot of times when you wake up, you know, your mouth is dry, you feel like, you know, you need water and stuff because you've been sleeping so long. And it could be a connection with all of that, too, just as you're waking up.
Well, that's what I always thought. I always thought it was just some sort of a natural manifestation of the whole sleep process.
The body is just starting to function again, you know.
But I would love to know where she's coming from. Where she got that from?
That's interesting to me too, because I've never heard her mention that. But I wouldn't be worried about it. Apparently, it's not affecting you in any way.
No, I mean, I'm not. Believe me, I've had many stranger things happen to me. Then, if I'm not worried about those, I'm certainly not worried about this.
It's just a curiosity.
It's a curiosity, and that's the word, just curiosity. But I won't take up any more of your time. I just wanted to know.
I don't get that many call-ins because people say they usually just want to listen.
Well, I'm one of those. I love to just listen.
I'm surprised when somebody does call.
Yeah, but like I said, it's a real pleasure, you know, speaking with you, and I love listening to you.
So some people say, oh, my question's probably stupid or dumb. I said, no question is dumb. If you want to ask it, there's always a reason. And so the main thing is I wouldn't worry about it.
No, I'm not.
Yeah.
I'm not.
It's just one of these odd things that we don't have the answer to. And if I remember when I talk to her again, I'll ask her.
I would appreciate that.
Okay.
And thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for calling in.
Good night and Happy New Year.
Okay. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, it's always a surprise because I sit here in this room talking to the wall, and that means there's somebody out there actually listening. And it always surprises me whenever the phone goes off and somebody comes in. They just make a little beep, so that's the only way I know anybody's on the line. But let's get back to what I was talking about. Let's see. I was trying to get to this story. All right. But my earlier books did deal with history. And to me, that's so fascinating to find the lost history. In a way, I wish I could get back to that. I loved it so much. Now I keep going further and further afield in my work to where I'm into the convoluted universe series and all of those. I'm going into this complicated metaphysics. So I keep getting further and further away from my first love. But the first part did have to do with history and lost history, because as I found, it was things that people didn't know or didn't have all the information about. Well, in the very beginning, my history was dealing with the Jesus books, and I've spoke about those before, especially around Christmas time. BBS Radio usually plays the Star of Bethlehem tape. But last week, Don Newsom wanted to talk with me, so we just did that instead. But for the last 2 years before that, they were replaying the Star of Bethlehem. So in those books, I got a lot of information that was never known about Jesus, the missing years, the missing parables, the missing stories. So that was getting back lost history. And then after that, I began writing the other books. Now, another book that I did dealing with lost history was A Soul Remembers Hiroshima. And a lot of people have told me they've read all of my books but that one. They said they didn't want to read about something that they considered to be so horrible as the atomic bomb exploding in Hiroshima. But I felt that book needed to be printed, because the man in the story became alive to me. And it was almost like he was haunting me, telling me, tell my story, please tell my story. And it's strange. I don't consider it a horrible book because it has a great deal of information that the world needs to know, especially right now when we're sitting on the brink of another atomic wars and things. Look at what's going on in Pakistan right now, because all of them have nuclear capabilities. And we don't know where we're going. But to me, I said on the back jacket, I said, it cries out to mankind, don't let this happen again. Now, that book was translated into Spanish, and when I was in Barcelona doing a book signing and a lecture there with a translator, this little old man came up to me holding the book in his hand, and he told me, he said, this is a very beautiful book. And I thought, that's strange to describe that book in that way. But it is telling a piece of lost history. Now, in that story, it's the same woman that I wrote about in the Jesus books. And this was how I met her. She was a young girl, only in her 20s when I met her. And we had no idea she had all this wealth of information in her. And that was how I first met her. We were first just doing ordinary past lives because it was just fun. It was my early days, and I was just learning how to do this. I ended up taking her through about 30 different lifetimes, and this took place over a long period of time. And just to see, because I was experimenting, just to see where we were going to go. And I took her through some that were rather simple, just ordinary. And then finally one day she told me the real reason, she said, I want to do this, that she'd been afraid to tell me before. She said, how do you know if something is real or not, if you have a memory? And I told her, if you have emotion with that memory, that's a good sign that it's real, because emotion cannot be faked. It has to come from somewhere. So she told me what had really been bothering her. She said, oh, it happened a year or so before. Now, this woman was in her 20s. She had dropped out of high school. She just wanted her freedom. Then she found out when she dropped out of high school, well, freedom is not free. You have to have some kind of an education. So she went into the Army and learned to be a computer operator. And that ended up being her skills that she used after she got out. But she never left this country. Well, she said it had been a few years before that, before I'd met her, that she was in her house, that she walked into the living room, and the TV was playing. And it was a documentary about the Second World War, and especially dealing with the bombing of Hiroshima, the dropping of the atomic bomb. And she said there were no scenes of what had happened. There were just these survivors were sitting there talking to the interviewer. And as she listened to them, she said all of a sudden she had these flashes come into her mind of what happened, like with the atomic bomb dropping of the people. She could see them running and screaming. And it was just like all of a sudden her mind, what's happening to me? Because this, it was a trigger, but it was not scenes on the TV. It was just all being triggered in her mind. And all of a sudden she knew she was, had been there. And she also knew, she knew she'd been a man, and she knew that she had survived for about a week after the bomb had gone off. Well, she said she went and turned off the TV, and she turned off the pictures, but she couldn't turn off the pictures in her mind. They were just playing over and over, and it was horrible what she was seeing. And she really thought she was going crazy, because she said, I'm not a man. I'm not Japanese. She was a young American blonde-haired girl. Now, where was all this coming from? So for two or three days after that, she said she really thought she was going crazy. It was just kept going around and around in her mind, and she couldn't get rid of it, and she didn't know what to do. So eventually she said the only way to get rid of it was just to push it to the back and forget about it and not think about it. But she couldn't figure out where did it come from. The emotions were overwhelming. So then she asked me, can we explore this? And I had already been working with her. She was an excellent subject. She was going a somnambulist who would go into these past lives and get so much information out of them. all the theological, all of the cultural, everything that happened in those time periods. It became alive and real. Now, the only other book I've done with her was that she was the one who had the Jesus material. It was the same woman. And some of the material in the book Between Death and Life came from the sessions with her also. But she had so much valuable information in these 30 different lives we went through that eventually it's going to be another book because there is so much history that I think needs to be told. But in the beginning, it was just very simple stuff. So I told her, well, we can explore this and see because I don't know if there was anything there or not. And it would have been her life just before she came into this life. She would have died and come back. I think it would have been within 10 years at that time. I'm trying to remember when she was born. But it's been very quickly that she came back into this lifetime. So we had the session, and I just took her back over to the 1920s just to see if there was anything there. And when I did, she was a Japanese, that time she was a Japanese young man or boy at that time, but she was living outside of Hiroshima, and they had like a farm. And they raised rice out there, and it was just a very ordinary, simple Japanese life. And when I traced the story, we did this for weeks. She would come back the next week. I would pick up the story again just to see about this man. And he was a potter. He would make pottery. And then he would take it into Hiroshima and sell it there at the market. So it's just very ordinary. I took him through his life. We went through the marriage ceremony, and I've traced all of this out. The historical parts, the traditions that she gave me were absolutely correct. Everything that she told me was the way it was in Japan during those days. And I don't know anything about Japanese traditions, and she didn't know either. We talked about the tea ceremonies, the kite parades they would have. All of the little things that make up the life of a Japanese person that we could not possibly have known. Well, she was living an ordinary life. She got married and had sons and was living outside of Hiroshima and still going in once a week to sell her pottery. And then the war broke out, and their lives changed totally. And this is when I began to get the lost history of Japan during World War II. Because later when I began to research this, I only found one or two books that were ever written by Japanese during that time to explain what they actually went through. A lot of them, just like just the whole gap there. All we know is what we know from America, what was going on at that time. We always considered them monsters, because they started the war, and we looked at them from that way. We never saw them as people. And the people today don't realize what the Japanese people actually went through on their side of the war. They didn't want this any more than the Americans did. When I'm traveling, I've always found people are just people everywhere you go. They're just ordinary people. All they want is to be left alone. They want to raise their families. They want to have a job to make money to support their families. They want to be happy. They don't want wars. It's always the leaders that do that. I tell people if more people traveled, we wouldn't have the wars. We wouldn't have the violence because we'd see that everyone, we're just alike, really. We all want the same things. And that's what these people wanted. They didn't know what was happening. Their whole world was being torn apart just the way the Americans were over here. The average people there didn't know anything about what was going on. And they were, this man, the Japanese man and his family, were trying to live out there, raise their rice, but the war was going on. Well, it didn't turn out the way they thought because they needed soldiers for the army, and they just came out in their trucks. They said they just marched right through the rice fields, destroying everything, and their trucks, and they took the two sons on the trucks and took them away to the army. No choice or anything. That's forcibly drafting them and taking them away. And then as the war became worse and they didn't have much food, it was like the rationing in the States, but over there was the same thing. They couldn't raise food. They were starving. Then they brought the trucks again and took his daughter-in-laws and took them into Hiroshima to work in the factories. And they had, like, government housing that they stayed in while the grandchildren and while they worked at the factories. So it was all forcible labor. But they didn't want any of this. And by this time, the man that this girl had regressed to was growing older, and it was just him and his wife living alone out there on this farm trying to survive the best way they could. It didn't do any good to try to go into Hiroshima anymore because nobody was buying things like pottery. He just had to survive. And when all of this was happening, his wife one day was walking on the road and was run over by trucks carrying the Japanese soldiers. So then he was left all alone by himself. So his only solution was to go to Hiroshima and live in the government housing with his daughter-in-laws and try to at least find some food for them and the grandchildren. So all of these things have never been told. And I think it shows we have to respect these other people. They're not our enemies. They're just people like us. So he was living in the government housing as we came to the time of the bomb would be dropped. And I had been following this story all along. And then this one that night when I was talking to her, I said, well, you know, the next session we have, there's only one more place to go. And that's the dropping of the bomb. And I said, do you really want to go through that and experience that? And she said, I don't know. Let me think about it. So the next week when she came, I was waiting for her decision. Because if she had decided it was too much, she didn't want to go through it. So even though she has no memory when she wakes up, still this is something very traumatic to go through. And if she had decided she didn't want to do it, I would not ever have pressed that because the free will is so important. And I have a great respect for the people I work with. I protect those people. I will not do anything to harm them. Now, I also knew as a hypnotist, I had her conditioned to the point if I was unscrupulous, didn't have any ethics, I could have taken her there at any time and had her go through it if it was just for my own satisfaction as a writer or whatever. If that was what I wanted, I could have taken her there at any time and had her relive it, and she wouldn't have had anything to say about it. Now, this is the way a lot of hypnotists work. They don't care about the person. To me, that is rape of the mind. I would never, ever do that. I cannot do that. My ethics are totally different. So the next week when she came for the session, I said, what do you decide? Do you want to do it or not? If you don't, we won't do it. And she said, I think I have to. I'll never be rid of it. I've got to find out what happened. I've got to go through it or I'll never be rid of it. So I said, all right, I promise you we will do it once. And we will never go near it again. And that was probably the hardest session I've ever had to do in my 30 years of working with the regressions and the hypnosis. To watch somebody actually re-experiencing being in the atomic bomb when it fell. She was in the marketplace as the man. She was in the marketplace when it dropped. And she said, it was, all of a sudden, it was just, people hear these tapes, when I used to play it, they couldn't listen to it. They would run out of the room crying. They said there was so much emotion when she's she said, "What's happening? You know, what's happening?" He said, "Everybody's running and screaming in the streets. They didn't know what was going on. The blinding flash of light and then the wind. And they had no idea what was happening. And then to see the people running with the skin falling off of their faces, off of their hands and arms." And she's in the middle of all of this, and the same thing is happening to her as this man. And I did the research. I found that many of them were just jumping into the river that runs through Hiroshima, trying to get away from the terrible heat. That it was absolutely horrible, and they called them the Walking Dead. But anyway, she goes through the entire thing, and she ends up, as we moved her forward through it, she was in a hospital that they had made a makeshift hospital where they had the survivors. But nobody knew what to do. The doctors had never seen anything like this. They didn't know anything about radiation poisoning. And it was just a total chaos. And due to all these people dying in this makeshift hospital, trying to treat them. And all she was doing as she lay there was, why? Why did this happen? Why did they do this to us? What did we ever do to them that justified them doing this to us? And she said, aren't we all the same? Don't we have the same kind of blood flowing through our veins? What did we ever do to justify this? It's so poignant. It is so emotional that I think if anybody went through this, they would see there is absolutely no point in atomic war at all, because it was so emotional to experience this. And we took her through the entire thing, and all she could think of, where are my children? Where are my grandchildren? And she was dying in utter despair. But I promised her that we would never do it again. We just went through that whole thing. But as she went through that, I saw her body change as she took on the effects of what was going on. Now, this is one of the most important things that I teach in my classes when you're doing past life regression, is to remove all physical effects before the person is ever brought out of trance. You don't want them carrying any of that into this life. And I have found the body remembers too. And you have to be extremely careful that you don't bring any of that into this life. So when I'm doing my classes, I teach the safeguards and all the things not to do when you're working with this deep, deep level of trance. So I had to be absolutely sure that before I brought her out of this whole thing, that she would have no after effects whatsoever. So the entire book tells my story with that. It's called A Soul Remembers Hiroshima. And after it was over, that man just seemed, well, she was totally, you know, relieved. It was gone. It never bothered her again. And it was wonderful to see her reaction. But I kept having dreams where this Japanese man was coming to me and saying, please tell my story. Tell people what really happened. And I knew I had to write that book. I knew it would not be popular, that it wouldn't probably not sell that many copies, but I knew I was compelled to tell that man's story. So that was one of the first books that I wrote. I wrote the Jesus books first, and then I wrote Hiroshima. And then I was doing the research when I was putting it all together. I went to the university libraries. I got out all of the old, the microfilms of all the newspapers back in the 1940s at the time of the event. Now, I was alive at that time. I was a teenager, but the story we were told, you know, our version of the war, was totally different than what I was discovering, because we saw it through the eyes of a teenager watching movies and news and things, and you see propaganda is what you mostly focus on. You don't see what's really happening, which is true of anywhere. But when I went back and began to look at the old newspaper articles at that time, I saw a whole different picture. And then I had all these photocopies of all these pages, and I laid them on the table, and I said, oh my gosh, is this what I'm supposed to write about? I said, well, I guess I am, or it wouldn't have been given to me. What I found was that we didn't need to drop that bomb, that the Japanese at that time were trying to surrender, and that the bomb was an experiment, and it had to be, something had to be done at that time, or how would they know if it was going to work? And I also, when I was doing the research, I tried to find all the books I could of the time period. And that's what I said, there is nothing written by the Japanese, only two that I could find. One was Hiroshima Diary, written by a doctor at the makeshift hospital. All of that turned out to be real. And there was a couple others, just I think one other one. The rest of them were written by Americans, military, and by people who were reporting the events. So I backed all of this up when I did the research of the newspapers, and I found out a story that I didn't want to tell about how when they were developing the bomb, it was first intended to be dropped on Germany because the war was still going on over there. And then we had the war with Germany ended, so they still have to drop it. You got to see if it's going to work. And they said the only way they could do it was test it during wartime, because otherwise you couldn't just drop it on a city or anything. You can't do it in peacetime. It would be absolutely horrible. Had to be done under wartime conditions in order to justify it. So that was when they knew they had to drop it on Hiroshima. They picked Hiroshima because all the other Japanese cities were being bombed on purpose. They left Hiroshima alone because they said if they were going to drop this bomb, they wanted to see how much damage it would do and not be influenced by the bombing that was going on in the other cities. So they, people living there couldn't figure out what was happening because the planes would fly over and the bombs wouldn't drop. They'd go on somewhere else. But they said they were doing that on purpose so that they would know how much damage would be done when they finally dropped the bomb. Now, they were determined to do it because they had to see what was going to happen. And at that time, according to the story I got, too, the people, the research I did, they didn't have any more shells. They didn't have bullets. They were shooting bamboo bullets. They didn't have equipment. They didn't have any of this. The war was winding down to where the people over there were starving to death, and they wanted to surrender. And they wouldn't allow them to surrender. And all of this is backed up by the meetings they were having in Europe at that time to trying to surrender, and they wouldn't let them. They had to drop the bomb. So that was the reason for dropping it, as an experiment to see what was going to happen. So, I mean, this is pretty horrible stuff that I was digging up, but I knew I had to write about it. So I told everything that I found, put it out there just to see what was going to happen. And it was only, a couple of years after I wrote the book and published it, they had two documentaries on TV and even had a movie later that backed up everything that I found, that it was an experiment and that it was dropped on purpose to see what was going to happen. So this was not what I was going to talk about tonight, but I think it's very appropriate because here we are again, sitting on the verge of what could be another atomic war without really understanding what it does. It's been said that nobody in Congress has ever witnessed, Congress, House of Representatives, the presidents, none of them have ever witnessed an atomic bomb explosion in the experiments they've done or the tests or anything. None of them have done it. They don't know the capabilities of it. They don't know what it's capable of. So here they argue about limited nuclear war and without even realizing what they're talking about. That was only one bomb, and it did horrible devastation. And here they're talking about The hydrogen bombs were invented after that, which were much, much more devastating. We have no idea what we're playing around here with. It should be left alone. We're making all the other countries in the world get rid of their weapons. What about ours? We shouldn't be thinking about this at all. We should just leave it alone totally because, oh, we're sitting on something that we could destroy the world if we don't know what we're doing. So that's why I thought it was funny when this old man came up to me in Barcelona and said, "This is a very beautiful book." I hadn't thought of it that way, but I think it tells the story. And as I said on the back jacket, it screams to mankind, don't let this happen again. I guess that's what I've ended up giving this talk about tonight. Anyway, let's hope that we aren't stupid enough to go down that way, that road. We're playing around with things we can't even begin to understand. All right, we're coming up to the time for me to stop. And I just want you to remember, if you want to get a hold of me or contact me, my website is www.OzarkMountainPublishing, and that's abbreviated by OZARKMT.com. Or for those of you in other countries, it's OZARKMT.com. It has my schedules, it has the lists of all the books, it tells you how you can order them. Everything is on that website. Or you can call my 800 number, 1-800-935-0045. 1-800-935-0045. Okay, and good night, everybody, and have a happy new year as we go into 2008. Good night.